Okay, so boom. You finally realize the power of emails and owning your own data. So you create a newsletter and get a landing page fired up. You send out your first email and bloop, it's in the promotions folder. Unless you're an e-commerce company, I'm sorry to tell you, but the promotion folder is not going to help you. This is why you should get ConvertKit. ConvertKit specializes in keeping your email in the primary folder so you can increase your open rates and communicate with your audience. They also have beautifully designed landing pages and squeeze pages for you to capture more emails. I personally love the fact that they have good support. Support for me is everything. If I have a problem, I need to know I can get someone on the line or have a video that answers all of my questions. Hustlers don't give up. They say, yo, let me figure this out. I figured it out with ConvertKit. And that's not the show. All right. Hello and welcome to the Hustle Over Everything podcast. This is the podcast where we receive stories, tips, and strategies from entrepreneurs who've done it to help you grow your business and take yourself to the next level as a person. Later today, we have Lance Chung on the podcast. Lance is the editor-in-chief of Bay Street Bull, and he's also an influencer in his own right. He's worked at multiple media brands, so we're going to dive deep into that. And make sure you guys follow us at 24/7 Hustler on Instagram and 24/7 Hustlers on Twitter. And now you can find Lance at Mr. Lance Chung on IG. Owen, bro, how you doing, fam?
Man, I'm great. You know, I'm inside. You know, I'm locked up. They won't let me out, you know. I'm locked up. Bro, that's what we're doing right now. We're locked up in the house. But all in all, man, I'm very happy, very healthy. I'd have my happiness, my work, my family. Happy to have you with me on this journey, bro. I'm very blessed. I gotta give my appreciation to you as well. So that's what's going on, man. It's like another January that's Januarying as usual. You know, every January feels like it's prolonged for some reason. It feels like it never ends. I don't know what it is about this month, but this is the fastest January that we've endured in the past like 4 years. Don't you feel like that?
Yeah, it definitely flew by, without a doubt. But we gotta get to the topics, man. Clubhouse,
bro.
Talk to me about it.
Okay, guys, so Alex has been trying to get me to get on Clubhouse for the past like 3 months, and I remember, I don't know if you guys remember, but we had an episode where on the wildcard episode when you're telling me like, hey bro, Clubhouse, then I have the iPhone, you don't have an iPhone, you have an Android. And I got on it, and I just kind of felt like I just didn't see the use case of it. Yesterday, my friend Simi, shout out to Simi, go check out her podcast, Time Out Podcast, great, great content. Simi invites me to this Clubhouse, which has like a lot of Black women. It was like a Black room where we're talking about relationships, we're talking about business, we're talking about careers, and etc. And I was invited as a speaker, so I found myself really enjoying the platform just because I could chime in my two cents here and there. And I realized the power it has to building relationships. I got like maybe 4, 5, 6 new friends just from that whole thing, following me on Instagram and, you know, collaborating like that. And Simi, what she did was she created a Time Out Podcast group, which I found very fascinating. She has about 80 people in there. And I'm thinking about what we're doing and the type of impact we're having towards entrepreneurship. And I just connected the dots. I was like, okay, Hustle Over Everything, why don't we have a group on this thing? Because we can connect with founders, VCs, angels, marketers, investors, and etc. So, and we love talking. We're already talking every day. So this is something that is open and we can attract audience. And it's hot right now, right? It's at the infancy stage. So just seeing that platform and just seeing it like for what it is, that's why I texted you. I was like, bro, Clubhouse is sick. I think what I did wrong the last time is I didn't have an open mind towards it, just because I always feel like we get bombarded with so much technology and so many apps that I just didn't want to like dive into another one and learn a new platform when I still have to yet to master other different platforms like TikTok and etc. So I didn't give it its proper due. But yesterday on Friday, I poured myself up, what drink? I made a margarita last night just to chill out and watch the Raps, defeat the Miami Heat. And I was chopping it up on Clubhouse, and I'm a believer now, so that's why I'm trying to get us ramped up. I know you're trying to get an iPhone just to get on Clubhouse so you can, you know, we can build this community. But bro, I'm a believer, man. I'm a believer.
Without a doubt, Clubhouse is going big. We predicted it, you know, on a few episodes ago. I think it was the Wildcard episode. We predicted that Voice is going to be huge, you know, with Ava DuVernay joining Spotify, and you know, Spotify investing so heavily into audio content. Clubhouse getting $1 billion valuation. There is huge potential for audio in 2021. So if you're not on it already, like you're already sleeping, or you're like me and don't have an iPhone, so I'm about to buy an iPhone just to hop on Clubhouse and start networking like crazy, so we can get you know, the best for us. So I'm excited about it. But what do you think about the valuation, man? Let's talk about it. So
Clubhouse just got a valuation right now of $1 billion. And I just read you off a post with one of the founders, like, of Blavity, Morgan DeBond, the founder and CEO. And what she was saying is pretty true. Because when we went to California and we met Chameleonaire, he was telling us he had a similar concept in the works. You know more about his platform. I haven't really dug deep into it, but he pitched us exact same idea. This is about 3 years ago. Like, I think 2018, October 2018. And Clubhouse comes out of nowhere. It's two founders who have launched the platform. And nothing wrong with that. But I think the key issue here is that how the Black community are key drivers of the apps that we use today. You know, we make Vine pop. We make Twitter pop. We make, now we're making Clubhouse pop, because we add the culture. We add the narrative. We add the fun to it. And we don't own these platforms. So we're benefiting the owners, but we don't have our own platform. So it goes back to what Tristan Walker was saying years ago. It's like Black culture is American culture. So the issue here is that as much as we add to these platforms and increase the value of it, we don't get a piece of the pie.
Without a doubt, man. It's unfortunate. You know, Convos is the app by Chameleonaire, which has almost the exact type of room set up that Clubhouse has. And it gets maybe 5,000 users. So it's unfortunate to see a Black-owned app like Convos, you know, go to the wayside, whereas another platform that is very similar get, you know, $1 billion valuation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's probably getting acquired in a few years, or Facebook's out there plotting on how they can use this. Exactly. So it's just a matter of time. Facebook's copied every platform: TikTok, Snapchat, Messenger, or MSN Messenger, you know. So it's just a matter of time before Facebook gets their hands on it and acquires it into their umbrella. So it's just a matter of time.
So let me ask you this, Al. Like, why do you think, with the ability of, like, with the knowledge that we have of what we do to culture, like the steam we provide these platforms, why do you feel like, even though we know other Black founders are, you know, building these platforms, we don't go to it? And, you know, I can say I'm guilty of it, because we met Chameleonaire. And to be fair, to also say this, I didn't even know Convos launched, right? Because, you know, I follow Chameleonaire. I didn't hear the conversations, or perhaps maybe I'm just not tapped in like I thought, like I think I am. But still, even though that we know that it exists, what do you think is the disconnect from us gravitating to our own backing, our own founders, and et cetera?
Finding the right use case, I think. I feel like Clubhouse people, and the timing. Clubhouse came out the exact right time. I feel like maybe Chameleonaire could have, you know, leveraged this time more to market heavier to get more people on the app. But I think Clubhouse was lucky in terms of the timing, man. We were all at home, not doing anything, and they started to boom. Same with Hangouts. Hangouts started to boom for that reason as well. So, or not Hangouts, House Party. House Party got to boom for that exact same way. So, you know, it's a part of the struggle.
Let me challenge you on that, right? You're saying timing, right? We've seen products launch this year that came up because we thought is the right time. One of them is Quibi, right? Quibi launched major bank, like hundreds of millions of dollars in financing, but they flopped. So is it timing is a thing here? Is timing matter or is it like execution?
Honestly, I think when it comes to this is that, like, you know, there was a problem that people had with communication during this time that Clubhouse solved. Mm-hmm. Quibi was a product that was trying to be sold to an audience, you know? So it was more of like having a problem and providing a solution versus having a product and selling it to a customer, you know, or trying to find the customer. And I think that's kind of where Quibi went off, is that they were just trying to like create. There was no one said, hey, I need 10-minute content from a big provider that's going to charge me the same as Netflix. No one really said that. I never felt that, you know, personally, that, hey, I need a new short form content that I'm paying for. If I want content that's short, I'll go to YouTube. Plain and simple. And it's free. Exactly. Free. So I think that's where Quibi messed up. If I was them, I would have made like a freemium platform where you could have came for free and joined for like maybe like 7 months or something like that to get them accustomed to the short form content, and then had a paid platform so they can get into the pattern of using it, you know, because like you always say, man, function follows form, you know. So getting into the practice of using something, like right now I'd rather use Canva than Photoshop, which is crazy, or because I'm practicing using Canva every day because it's free, right? Then once I want to get to the higher levels, then I'll pay for Canva probably. So that's what I'm saying, is, you know, using that in a regular practice. But in regards to Clubhouse versus Quibi, I think it was a problem solving that Clubhouse had at that exact moment versus what Quibi was just like, hey, this is another content piece.
Yeah, and I think Quibi was very bullish in banking on that. This verticalized video platform is going to take over just because we hold our phones like this every day. But I don't think we're ready to have video in a vertical form, you know? Like, we watch videos, but like on Instagram and et cetera, but it's not as the camera paneling isn't as squeezed as it were on Quibi. So, I mean, you know, Quibi's
got acquired. The content got acquired by Hulu. The platform is dead, but the content got acquired for a steal.
Yeah. As Kevin Lurie says in Shark Tank, you know, just take that behind the barn and shoot it. And I think, you know, that's what they did, right? But man, Clubhouse, bro. Let's talk about that real quick before we hop into the business tip of the week.
Yes. Hustlers, would you like a room? Are you guys on Clubhouse? Let us know. DM us at 24/7 Hustler on Instagram. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, I think it's a powerful platform, and I think we have an opportunity here that we got to capitalize on immediately. Yes,
most definitely. So let's get into this tip of the week. Today, I want to talk about UGC, user-generated content. What is user-generated content? Real simple, it is when a user generates content. It's literally that simple. It's when you have a customer that uses your stuff, make a post, quote, image, video about your product. If you're not familiar, get familiar, because it's going to impact your business in a positive way. When I was working with a client, I would leverage UGC consistently. It's free. All you have to do is incentivize people by having a hashtag or reposting them on your feed, and they would want the clout off that, or just proud of that purchase and want to showcase that purchase. What is good about UGC is that it allows you to have brand authenticity and social proof. Ways you can generate UGC include hashtags, reviews, video reviews, and quotes. And the ways to get them is by saying, hey, use this hashtag when you post on Instagram. Also, send us an email of your favorite XYZ from our product or service. a use case for case studies that's worked really well is using them with abandoned cart emails. A lot of us have people sitting in our abandoned cart folder on our Shopify's, on our WooCommerce, on our websites, are just sitting there collecting dust. And we could easily hit them with an email to say, hey, I know you came to buy. Here's what other people are doing with our product. This is why you should buy it. Also, you can use it in the social ads. You can use it to target net new users to say, hey, look at all these people using our product. Also, you can use it for retargeting. One thing I want to suggest is incentivize video reviews. Use that content on your social ads, on your product page. And with ads, video reviews work wonders, especially on ads. Just because you have that content forever, and it will be an authentic way of communicating how your brand serves your customer. So real simple, use UGC content for your brand, use it for your abandoned carts, use it for your social ads and your social media. And that wraps up the business tip of the week.
Bang, bang, bang. Let's get it. UGC is definitely huge, bro. I think it allows you as a brand to get momentum, allows engagement, and also people, when they participate in that, it also builds a brand mind share, because when people are talking about your brand in a natural way, it associates that this is actually legitimate. This brand has authority. So definitely UGC is definitely up there.
It's a sleeper. Because I think almost at this point, a lot of people still know about it, but it kind of falls to the wayside sometimes. And you want to get into the notion of, hey, I got to create content, but you got to incentivize other people to create content for you as well. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's free. Mm-hmm. It's literally free marketing.
I think it just comes down to strategy. Like, how are you going to get people to do that? Like, it also takes skill to get people to feel motivated to make like user generated content from what you're doing. And, I think if you master it, then you're on your way up there, like as a marketer. Like, you know, you just got to sit back and, you know, let people talk about you and build up impressions and hopefully converts into sales.
Well, most definitely. Oh, two examples that I can share with you guys that I've seen do or use UGC well is C Eyewear, SEE Eyewear, or Fresh Heritage. Those are two brands that really use UGC to increase their engagement on social media, and you can use it on their ads. It's a really important tool, guys. So yeah, let's get into the Hustle Nation, man.
Yeah. You already know what time it is. It's Mr. Hustle Muscle ready to give you the Hustle Nation tip of the week. Today, I want to discuss practicality in business. So we had Brian Clayton on the podcast last week, and we just touched upon it, but we didn't go too deep into it. So I just want to start off by saying, you know, we've experienced waves of ventures in different industries coming out of nowhere and taking the market by storm. So nearing the 2010s, we saw the emergence of social media apps such as Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Snapchat make waves. Over the years, a handful of companies have come and have become staple products in our day-to-day lives. I mean, just look at your phone and you'll know what these businesses are. The Vault stayed here to this day. And all of them are billion-dollar companies. So what this did is it created a paradigm shift to every aspiring entrepreneur. Everyone saw the acquisitions Facebook was making, throwing billion-dollar offers to companies such as Instagram and Snapchat. We saw the emergence of businesses out of the valley receiving millions of dollars in funding. This was the gold rush. Everyone wanted to be in tech in the hopes of becoming one of these success stories. Everyone wanted to be part of this elite club. And a part of it is that it seems so easy. You know, you think of this imaginative concept that is so simple, but yet it's so potent that it can have the power of bringing millions of people together to use it. We saw incubators pop up all around the world, and everyone now was considering themselves a tech entrepreneur. Everyone was now a co-founder of something. Tech became the new Hollywood, and everyone was chasing their big break. Startup words were formed to let people know you belonged and you knew what you're talking about. But, you know, I got to break it down here real quick. As a tech entrepreneur who's dabbled in tech, the harsh truth of the reality is that, you know, entrepreneurship is hard. One out of a million will have a shot of building a unicorn company. So when I talk about unicorn company, what I mean by unicorn is that these companies are up there in the upper echelon. These businesses transcend culture and everyone adjusts their lives to use them because they have made an impact in society. If you don't use these services, you feel like you're missing out. They change industries and turn old incumbents archaic. These are like generational businesses. The way you have generational talents in the NBA, such as LeBron James, is the same way you have generational businesses. And these are like the Airbnbs, the Slacks, the Ubers, the WhatsApps, and et cetera. Making it to that level is extremely hard. And if you're an entrepreneur, you've definitely thought about it. I personally have definitely thought about it like time and time again. Chasing this dream is welcome, but in my personal opinion, you're doing yourself a disservice. You'll spend such a long time trying to create the next Facebook or Uber for something else, a social media app for X. And at the end of the day, you're in business to make money and a profit. So practicality wins at the end of the day. The thing about these businesses is people create a concept with no business model in mind. They create these concepts which are absurd just to raise money with the hopes it sticks with the masses. These are some of the dangers of tech. Each day, someone discovers a new way of doing something, but the tech industry presents no blueprint to follow. Everyone is a ship without a rudder hoping to find that island. So you have a way better chance of creating a business and having it, you know, generate $5 million in revenue than chasing the goal of creating this big tech business to cash in on $1 billion. I'm not saying it can't be done. It definitely can. But the odds are so slim, you're better off creating a business with a viable business model from day one and working on acquiring customers every day who are willing to pay. You know, the days of building an app and then getting funding because you have an app, just because you have an app, are over. The Hustle Nation tip of the week is be practical and focus on building a business from day one with a proven business model and not just some airy concept that you think is cool in the hopes of having angel or VC money thrown out at you, in the hopes that you can become the next big Airbnb star or Dropbox from Y Combinator. And that is the Hustle Nation tip of the week, guys. Be practical with your businesses. Still think big, still think of out of the box, but don't chase the pipe dream of becoming the next X of certain industry because it's extremely hard and you'll spend a long time trying to get there. Be practical, choose a business model, get customers, and just put your head down and grind it out. And that is the Hustle Nation tip of the week.
Amazing, man. Man, that was good. Now let's hop into our podcast with Lance Chung.
Let's hop in there, bro.
Let's go. Hey, what's up, guys? To support this show for free, here are some main options. If you're on Apple, make sure you rate and write a review of our podcast. This makes a huge difference and helps support the show. If you're on Spotify, follow us. If you're on Google Play, hit subscribe and auto-download so you'll be notified and have a fresh pod ready to go when we drop. Lastly, make sure you share the podcast on Instagram or whichever social platform you use and tag us. On Twitter, we're at 24/7 Hustlers. On Instagram, we're at 24/7 Hustler. And on Facebook, we're Hustle Over Everything. And now, guys, gotta pay attention to this point. We just dropped a new newsletter. It's called The Underrated. It's a weekly newsletter that breaks down untold stories that highlight game-changing business strategies that shape our sports, music, and culture. It drops once a week on Mondays, early in the morning, to prep you for the week. So subscribe to that, and we'll see you in the pod. Awesome. Lance, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, good. I'm happy to be starting the new year and happy to be joining you guys on the podcast. Thanks so much for having me.
Unreal, man. First and foremost, I just want to say thank you for coming on. I admire the work that you do for Bay Street Bull. Ever since I found about the platform, found about you as like one of the driving forces behind it, we've grown an admiration for the work that you've done with the features that you've covered, Mission Critical, like the podcast and the type of guests that you have on. So we really want to talk about the work that you do, how brands and businesses can get involved. So yeah, we're very excited to have you, man.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind words. I appreciate it. I'm excited to be chatting today.
Amazing. So as an icebreaker, I have a few questions for you. Mm-hmm. One, you're a self-proclaimed carb lover. What's your favorite carb and why?
I love all carbs. I'm Korean, so rice is definitely has to be up there. But I have to say that pasta is like, I can always eat pasta. There will never be a day where I won't want to eat it. And bread too. I just like them all.
It's so reliable.
Pasta for sure. Yeah.
Pasta is so reliable.
My partner actually just recently bought himself a Christmas gift over the holidays, and it's a pasta maker. So now he's doing it from my kitchen, and it is very indulgent and honestly just a wonderful delight.
That's amazing, man. I'm a pasta lover myself. I love bread as well. I used to
love them all.
Once I went to my first Italian restaurant and saw that they dipped bread in oil, I was like, what is this?
Was it olive oil?
Yeah, and olive oil. So olive I just started doing that at home all the time. I just started,
this is nice, man.
Exactly. So now let's talk about your early days. You know, you were an intern at Sharp Magazine. Was that your first entrance into digital media?
It was my first entrance into media in general, actually. I went straight to Sharp from university. So I was interning while I was at university. I went to university not for journalism, but for business. And part of our requirements to get our degree was to secure an internship. Mm-hmm. And so that's the internship that I had pursued when I was in school. And, our school had set us up with a lot of their business contacts, and none of them really spoke to me. They were really very big corporations like Walmart and stuff. And I was a marketing major, and so it just never appealed to me. And so I wanted to find an internship on my own, and that's how I landed at Sharp and Toronto in general. And so I did that while I was in school. Then I went back to finish the rest of my degree, and then I came here right afterwards. So it was pretty much back to back.
Amazing. So what were some of the highlights of working at Sharp? You know, because I think that was kind of the ascension of you into the digital media world, right? So what were some of the highlights that you learned that you can impute into our listeners?
From my internship programs, or while I was an intern, or as just working there in general?
I would say working there in general. You know, after you got there, after you landed the position there, you know, what were some of the things you learned at Sharp that, you know, really structured the way you approach media today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, obviously it was my first experience working for a media company in general. And mm-hmm. so I learned a lot from my experience working there, and everything from, you know, working with publicists to understanding the editorial planning process, social media. I mean, at that time, and I'm dating myself a little bit, but at that time, social media was just starting to be used as a business tool. And so part of my internship requirements was that I had to write a research paper on a topic that would be of use to the internship company or to the company that I was interning for. And so I did that on social media because that was the early days of Instagram and Twitter, and really when businesses were starting to leverage those social media platforms as a business tool. And so I learned a lot there about, you know, building community. Mm-hmm. And just, yeah, I mean, everything from top to bottom, just in terms of how a small media company functions. And I was really intentional about trying to find a company that was a little bit smaller in size, because it was very clear to me that, especially in media and marketing, you know, these big companies, they look great on a resume, but how much do you actually really get out of those internship experiences? I did not want a, you know, go and grab me a coffee kind of internship experience. I wanted to make sure that I was able to develop and come out of it with a well-rounded skill set and a well-rounded roster of contacts as well. So I learned a lot from that experience. And obviously that was Sharp specializes in fashion and luxury lifestyle. And so it was really a good masterclass in understanding your community and understanding your brand. And it was really an extension of my marketing degree, because it's, you know, these are all things that I learned in school that I was able to put into practice.
Going into Sharp, like, what would you say like your strongest asset you had coming into as an intern? What did you tell them that you could offer them? And leaving the internship, what other new skills did you gain from that you took onto your next opportunity?
I don't know if I offered a ton of stuff while I was an intern, to be honest. But as I said, like, you know, my research paper was on social media. And at that time, there weren't a lot of companies that were, or there, you know, that was just something that companies were just starting to embrace. Yeah. And so maybe that was kind of where I was able to be of use in that, you know, that's the reason why I was hired back, was to help handle their social media at the beginning. Yes. And so I wrote the research paper from my internship. I was able to provide a business case for using social media. Obviously, nowadays you can't launch a brand or a business without having a social media presence. But back then it wasn't always that obvious. And so creating a business case for it, and understanding the ability to, you know, cultivate communities and your voice was something that maybe I was able to offer that they didn't have anyone assigned to at that time.
Most definitely. And I'm curious, how do you correlate social media to magazine sales? That must have been a challenge back then without the social proof of the past. Because I know in corporate, they're always looking at past data. Hey, what's a year on year on X, Y, and Z, right? So what were some of the ways you correlated value when you were just starting there? And how do you correlate value today? Do you still look at metrics? And that'll be part two, but I would love to hear your answer to the first part.
I mean, how do I correlate value? I mean, it's like any other business. It's not even specific to media companies. Effectively, your content and your audience is kind of your product. And so you are able to use social media as a way to amplify your content, as a way to reach out to your communities, as a way to build stronger relationships with them and cultivate them. I think before, especially in media, there was this kind of... you know, there were a lot of gatekeepers, and the access to editors and people that worked inside media companies was very, very limited. And so this really opened things up and allowed editors and brands to speak directly to readers. And it just offered a little bit more of an intimate feel where you could have conversations and you were also able to get feedback, and you know that feedback was better was used to better inform your business decisions. So you know, amplification, cultivation, and you know, the ability just to understand your brand and your audience better. And I think that still continues today.
Now, pivoting to Bay Street Bull, for people who don't know, what kind of magazine is Bay Street Bull, and what can people expect from reading the content?
Yeah, so, you know, we started Bay Street Bull. Well, I didn't start Bay Street Bull, but, you know, Bay Street Bull started off as a print publication. Now we are, you know, leaning less towards describing ourselves or using magazine as a descriptor, because we don't want people to see us just as a print product. We really define ourselves as a multimedia platform. And so we have a print product, which is a big part of our business model. We also have our digital platform, and then we also have events, experiential. That's something that is a big part of our business model, and making sure that we're able to have, you know, before COVID, one-on-one interactions with our audience and at events, and be able to facilitate one-on-one interactions between our advertisers and our audience. And then this year we also launched, a little bit earlier last year, we launched a B2B arm of our business, which is effectively being able to white label and create content for other brands that are not under the Bay Street Bull banner. So we define ourselves as a multimedia platform that focuses on the intersection between business and culture, because we really saw that there was a rising culture around entrepreneurship and around building business that was not covered as much as we thought, you know, there could be coverage. And so we wanted to build that bridge out of the silo of just entrepreneurship and be able to connect that with culture and really acknowledge the fact that people are very diverse in their interests. You know, someone that's in finance could also be interested in fashion and food, and someone that's in fashion could also be interested in food and finance. So we wanted to acknowledge that people are very well-rounded in their interests and be able to offer a destination where people were able to consume that kind of content.
When did you launch, and when did you and your team launch Bay Street Bull?
So I've been at Bay Street Bull for 5 years, I think. I can't even tell. Time just works differently for me now, but I think around 5 years, maybe 5 or 6 years. But before I joined, Bay Street Bull was around for maybe about 8 years before that. So it's been around for a little while, and it's gone through a lot of different evolutions. Our current publisher, who's also the owner, bought it from the previous owner. And so when he did that, he wanted to restructure it. It was more of like a trade publication back then. Mm-hmm. And then he took it over. And then when I joined a few years after that, wanted to use my experience at Sharp to cultivate it into more of a consumer facing lifestyle business hybrid. Mm-hmm. And it's just been an evolution since then.
Amazing. Amazing. And what have you learned from growing the business? You know, because right now you have a different elements in the business with the one-on-ones, with the events, with, you know, the print product. So how have you been able to handle the unapologetic market, you know, because it's consistently moving? So how have you been able to steer clear in those waters?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that has always remained true for us at the publication is that we've always been a very, very small team of people. And that obviously has its limitations in terms of capacity and resources. But the biggest benefit of having a team that is oftentimes 8 people or less is that you're able to make quick decisions and be very nimble and agile. And so when it comes to an industry and a market that is as volatile as media, you're able to react quickly, and it doesn't take you, you know, there's not a huge chain of command that you have to go through for an approval process to make decisions. You can just turn around in your office and ask your coworkers, you know, what do you think about this? Let's go, let's do it. Let's see what sticks on the wall and go ahead with it. You're able to recover from your mistakes pretty quickly too. And so I've been of the belief that, being a small business has given us the ability to be very agile and nimble in an industry that is always changing, that is always throwing you curveballs. And so being able to react and being able to foresee and predict those changes and being able to prepare for those changes has really helped us navigate the volatility, because there's definitely a lot of volatility from a macro industry standpoint, one being from the shift from print to digital, things like COVID, the pandemic, how that's affected media consumption and production, to, you know, micro things in terms of handling your relationships with your advertisers. There's something new every day. So being a small team has allowed us to really be able to act quickly. And I don't think that that's something that is as easy to do in a large organization and a big kind of corporate organization.
Bay Street Bull, from looking from the outside in, living here in Toronto, it's like a Toronto-based media publication. It being based out of Toronto and focusing on Canadian entrepreneurs, how do you attract readers that are not familiar with the Bay Street Toronto culture and et cetera? And do you just plan on keeping it as just as a local Toronto Canadian type of publication? How do you attract different audiences from different countries and et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, Bay Street obviously has Bay Street Bull definitely has its brand built into a geographic location, being, mm-hmm. Bay Street, the financial district of Canada. But, you know, one of the things I quickly realized that a lot of Canadians actually don't even know what Bay Street is. So we've never really put all of our eggs in that basket and really wanted to make sure that our brand represented the culture of business and Bay Street being a symbol of business, but we've never limited ourselves to just focusing on businesses on Bay Street. In fact, a lot of our businesses are outside of Bay Street because, a lot of our coverage ends up talking about startup founders and tech entrepreneurs, and a lot of those are not located on Bay Street. So we really focus on talking around the culture of business, leadership, and the pursuit of success, however you define success. And I think that that is something that resonates with people across the board, whether you're Canadian or American, whether you're from Toronto or Vancouver or Calgary. And we want to make sure that we are very inclusive in our coverage and making sure that it's not just Toronto businesses that are being covered. We have distribution outside of Toronto. We have distribution across Canada. And so we need to make sure that we're recognizing and acknowledging our audience outside of Toronto, and also just not contributing to the stereotype that Torontonians are self-obsessed and that's, you know, it's Toronto versus the world. So we want to, and as a person that did not grow up in Toronto, that is very important to me. And so I think those geographic boundaries are less defined, and really the core of it is talking about everyone's journey to achieving success and how they define success. And so we, one of our mandates is really to highlight Canadian businesses, but not for the sake of doing so. We want to highlight Canadian businesses because they're some of the best businesses in the world. And so we also have American businesses that we featured. We had Arianna Huffington on our most recent cover. We had Whitney Wolf Heard from Bumble, Gary Vaynerchuk. So we've had a lot of American entrepreneurs, but we always want to come back to, you know, focusing on Canadian success stories because they're some of the best ones in the world, and because there aren't enough people talking about Canadian businesses in the bigger picture.
Most definitely. Hold on, I just got to address that real quick. So there's a stereotype of Torontonians being self-obsessed.
You know, they call it like, we got a screw face mentality, bro.
Well, that's something different, because that's more like being, you know, standoffish. But being self-obsessed is a bit different. I didn't know that Toronto had that
stereotype. No, you didn't. Well, I mean, maybe that speaks to... Did you grow up in Toronto? Maybe that speaks to growing up in Toronto.
Shout out Scarborough.
Yeah, I mean, I think for people that live outside of Toronto, certainly when I was growing up, you know, I grew up in Alberta, but I think it was just like... There was this idea that Torontonians were just obsessed with themselves, were only cared about themselves, and they were the center of the universe, basically, you know? But I don't know if that's necessarily the case anymore. I mean, I've lived in Toronto for almost 10 years, so maybe my perspective has been skewed a little bit, but yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, cool. What I find interesting with, you know, the new landscape of media is working with brands now. Because it's hard to... Not hard, but you got to be a lot more creative, I feel, in the collaboration process and delivering value. How have you found that brands are receiving value in your experience working with brands through your own influencer campaigns with Mr. Lance Chung on your Instagram account, or on the Bay Street Bull, or with the Glory Media?
Yeah, I mean, every brand defines, I guess, value in different ways. For us as a company, we really want to make sure that because we're a small company, relationships and solidifying very strong relationships are extremely important. I think being able to build those long-term relationships have been probably, you know, it's one of the biggest reasons that we've been able to see any kind of success in cultivating relationships. So I think it depends. I mean, from a strict advertiser perspective, being able to deliver on what they're trying to, you know, what they're trying to deliver on is important. You obviously want to get the right audience in front of their brand, whether that's a luxury brand or whether that's a timepiece consumer or a, you know, scotch drinker or a car enthusiast. You want to be able to make sure that you're able to deliver the right audience for them and be able to help them grow their audience. But outside of that, I think it's really about making sure that you are communicating with your brands, being authentic and being sincere, and just, I think, making sure that every conversation you have with them is not sales-based or revenue-based. You want to build a relationship that is two ways and make sure that everyone's happy. And for us, you know, offering to, if it's an American advertiser, offering to provide any insight into the market that they may not have because they don't have any boots on the ground here. So if they're opening up a new store, offering advice in terms of, okay, if you need any intel on you know, what's an area that you should consider opening up a store and what's not a good area that you should consider opening up. That's something, connecting people with, other leaders or decision makers in the community, just being of value to an advertiser or a brand is really important, and making sure that not every single conversation is sales based, because you know that'll get old and it'll just feel very transactional, and that's not how you build a relationship, not a long term one at least.
So like for example, like new brands, I mean smaller businesses who are coming into the mix, they want to approach a, let's say a fashion brand or like a liquor brand, they want to partner with these different, and you're talking about building a relationship, a long-term relationship. For small brands, small businesses looking to cultivate that relationship, there's a sort of timeline they have to, they have an objective at the end of the day is to partner with them. What are some relationship cultivating techniques that you could tell our audience? You're a small company, you want to approach a big brand to work with. What are some methods and techniques to go on about building a relationship the right way when you don't really have time on your hands because you do have a business to build out? What has worked for you and building that relationship with brands that might not be in Toronto, that might be outside of Canada? How do you cultivate that relationship and nurture it where you can actually drive it towards making that sale and getting that partnership?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest mistakes that people make when it comes to building relationships, whether or not that is with a brand and a media company or an intern with an editor, or you know, applying for a job, you know, I think the biggest mistake is that people often try to showcase their best qualities and why they think that they're a good fit for a company, or why they think that their media brand is a good fit for the brand. I think, and that's good. That's definitely not something to miss, but one thing that you have to do is empathize and and put yourself in the other person's shoes and understand what their goals are. And so if you're a small media brand and you're trying to approach a luxury watch brand, for example, as an advertiser, you need to put yourself in their shoes and understand what they're looking for and what they would get out of working with you. Not in terms and not see it from a perspective of you, why you think that they're such a great brand. You know, like they know that they're a great brand. They know that, I'm sure that they're getting tons of pitches all the time. And so you need to be able to identify what it is that they're looking for and be able to communicate why you're able to deliver that. And so if you're a luxury watch brand, obviously you'll know that if you're trying to pitch to one, you'll know that they want to make sales. They want to make, they want to, more introductions into the marketplace that you're in. They want some sort of value. So understand what value you can provide to a brand versus why you want to work with the brand. It's a subtle distinction, but I think it's an important one because even in the case of an internship, you know, we go through a lot of applications, and a lot of the times an intern will say, I want to work with you because I've always loved your content. I love doing, you know, I've always wanted to pursue a job in media. I always, you know, I love the business landscape, whatever it might be. And that's great. But if you're competing against a bunch of other people, what would make the person on the other side of the table care? And so you have to be able to communicate your value and what you're able to deliver on, and make sure that those values align with the brand or the editor or whoever the job hire, what they're looking for. And so I think that's the most important thing, is understanding what people are looking for and how you're able to deliver on it and how you're uniquely able to deliver on it that your competitors aren't able to do or that they haven't gotten a bunch of pitches for. And so one good way of doing that is if you have history being able to do that and being able to deliver, then build up some case studies and deliver and showcase quantifiable metrics that showcase your ability to deliver on whether it's impressions or sales or connections. Align yourself or deliver communication around your ability to align yourself with leaders in the industry. Things like that, you know, it's not rocket science, but you do have to put your mind in the shoes of the person that you're pitching to. in any scenario.
I completely agree. Our case studies are huge, most definitely. Yep. Also reviews. I want to throw that in there as well. Reviews from past people that they've worked with, because knowing that another person had a great experience with you can be a good testament to and motivated to work with you.
Testimonials are really important. Yeah, for sure.
I'm curious, do you find yourself pitching more towards agencies or internal operators that want to work with media brands like yourself?
We do a mix of both. It's multi-pronged. So we focus on efforts are really just on tackling as many different decision makers as possible. And it's not the same across the board. Some brands handle those decisions internally. Other brands outsource that to agencies. So we do a mix of both.
Got you. Working towards wrapping up, I know I want to be respectful of your time here.
We got some time.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. With COVID-19, you've pivoted the business to have a lot more of a digital presence, creating, digital covers. And by the way, that cover with the Aboriginal man, that was
mint.
Chef's kiss.
We were talking about that internally last week on our production meetings, and it's one of our favorite covers that we've done. And obviously the visuals are so important. And so the photographer Norman Wong, he took those photos for a TikTok campaign, and they just were so vibrant and beautiful and just imbued so much energy and emotion through that photo. So it was one of our favorite ones for sure.
Got you. Now, a lot of, we have a diverse audience. A lot of entrepreneurs now have to have a media front end and business back end because of the nature of COVID-19 and the nature of having an online presence. You need content on the front and the business on the back end, right? You're seeing that yourself, correct? So now that you've had so many years in media, what do you see small entrepreneurs doing correctly? And what do you see them doing incorrectly?
Small entrepreneurs doing correctly. I mean, I think it's really just important to understand who you are as a brand, establish what your mission is. That's the core perspective of our podcast, is understanding at the core of it, at your foundation, what's the ground beneath your feet that you are looking to build upon? And so, if you want to build a brand, what is that built on? Is it built on values around sustainability? Is it built around values or around diversity, whatever it might be? But understand who you are and what is your point of view. I think even when we get a lot of pitches for editorial coverage, there are a lot of people who pitch for the sake of pitching, but don't really know what they're really pitching other than their own company. But there's no point of view, there's no perspective. And so I think that's really important, especially today, to have a set of values and a point of view and perspective that you stand by and that inform the decisions you make as a company, both internally and externally. So whether that's from your hiring process to your editorial coverage or the type of products that you might produce to the way that you interact with consumers or readers, it's really important to have those basics covered, because if you don't know who you are, then how are you supposed to know what you're selling or what kind of community you want to build or what kind of company you want to build? So I think that's the most important thing, and not trying to do too many things at once. I think it's better to do one thing very well than a bunch of things in a mediocre way. So focus on, a handful of core objectives and doing those in the best way that you can and delivering those the best way you can, because you can't do everything, as we've learned. And I think lastly, there's this discussion that I have with a lot of founders and entrepreneurs around the difference between progress and perfection. And I think as small business owners, as entrepreneurs, people are always wanting to put out the best first impression, and that can really hinder progress. And so I think one of the things that I've really learned from our interviews and from our own experience internally is just put it out there and build on it and scale it up and iterate on it instead of waiting for the perfect time or the perfect product to put out. Because if you feel like your product is perfect by the time you put it out, it's too late. And so you don't want to miss out on any windows of opportunity because you just didn't feel like it was perfect. And that's really important.
You've had like, you have different brands, sub brands under Bay Street Bull. You know, you got Mission Critical now. You also have like the 30 and the 30 list that you currently do right now. What are some new, you know, sub brands under Bay Street Bull that you guys are planning on launching in 2021?
You know, I don't know if we have any
overall, like coming up.
Yeah. I don't know if we have any new products or series per se that we, are planning on rolling out in a similar sense to Mission Critical and 30 by 30 and stuff like that. Not any that I can share just yet, but I think for us, a big focus is to really continue to cultivate our existing products and our existing series and communities and sub products and sub communities and make sure that we're doing those well. We're nurturing those because we've worked really hard to build those up and we want to make sure that they continue to sustain themselves and they continue to build communities and expand. So for us, Mission Critical Podcast, I mean, we have 12 episodes of that so far, and it's become a big priority for us internally as a business objective to continue building on that. So we're going to continue releasing episodes of that. We have our 30 by 30 guide, which focuses on talented young business and cultural leaders. We have our Power 50 series, which is really the 50 businesses and people that are shaping Canada. Women Who Lead is a really important sub community and I guess kind of sub product of our brand, because we wanted to, the reason why we started that one was twofold. One, because people always perceived Bay Street Bull as a men's publication or as a men's media brand. Maybe that's because they associated with Bay Street in general, which is, you know, so we wanted to make sure that we communicated that we were not a gender focused publication. We are not a magazine for men. We're not a media company for women. We're a media company that focuses on the pursuit of success. And obviously, regardless of your gender, that can apply to you. So Women Who Lead, with that being said, we do want to acknowledge that women are disproportionately represented in business, that women do not have the same experiences as men in business. And there's a lot of work that still needs to be done there. So we created Women Who Lead because we wanted to give more space to talk about and celebrate female entrepreneurs and leaders. So that's a really important series for us. It's a weekly series online, and it's also an entire issue that we dedicate in the fall towards celebrating stories around female entrepreneurship and success. And then one of our most recent ones is How I Did It. So we did, we've done two guides on that so far, and it's just kind of a end of year wrap up on how various entrepreneurs or businesses have surpassed a significant milestone and are impacting communities. So those are our sub brands for now, and we're looking to build, but we don't want to bite off more than we can chew. We don't want to do something unless we can do it well and being able to nurture it. And, you know, as I said, we're a small company, so we only have so much capacity. We have six people, I think, on our team right now, six or seven. So it's, there's only so much we can do as well. It's a capacity issue. There's a lot that we want to do. But at the end of the day, you know, you can't have one person handling a million things, and you can't prioritize everything because then nothing becomes a priority. So it's understanding your pace and cadence as well.
Yeah, I definitely think that you have a lot to chew right now. Mm. You know, you have a lot to chew. Yeah. One thing I actually wanted to highlight and just say, give you kudos, is that, you know, you've taken it upon yourself as a company to highlight Black-owned businesses as well. You know, could you shed some light on the decision to highlight all these companies that you've done? Because I know, like, I saw Spencer Badu, shout out to Spencer, he was on the podcast as well. Also, Carlin Purcell, a makeup for Melanin Women as well, or Melanin Girls, I believe, MFMG, who's also on the podcast. So,
Rebecca, yeah.
I would love to get your insight into the decisions that you made there, because it was definitely intentional, and I would love to hear more.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is a very much an intentional, conscious part of our decision-making process. For me, you know, I'm the majority of our team consists of people of color. And so we really wanted to make sure, you know, from the beginning, our one of our core pillars and mandate is to make sure that we're highlighting diverse stories around success, mm-hmm. and making sure that stories around success, make sure that we are showcasing the fact that there's more than one face to success. And so as a team that consists mostly of people of color, that's always been a very, very important mandate of ours. Obviously, with the Black Lives Matter movement and everything that has happened in 2020, that is something that we've really wanted to build further upon with our content that speaks specifically to BIPOC content. And so, yeah, I mean, we want to make sure that we're highlighting stories around, you know, Black business excellence, around people who are working in business and in culture, and making sure that we're also consulting with people in the community to make sure that we understand what's happening on the ground too. You know, we have our hands in a lot of different buckets because we focus on a lot of different topics, from lifestyle to tech and business, and we can't always be the experts on everything. You know, from tech coverage, we look to institutions and organizations like Mars and Ryerson DMZ to understand, you know, and get and consult them to understand what are the companies that we should consider looking at. And so in the same way for BIPOC focused businesses and individuals, we want to make sure that we're consulting with other leaders in the community. We've spoken with Wes Hall, who is also, you know, great. We've done a lot of interviews with Masai and just,
that was my favorite, Lance. That was my favorite. I'm a huge
fan
of Masai.
I mean, he's just incredible in general. And so, and just making sure that we are very conscious. I think it's just, it's easy to get caught up in the day-to-day things. And I think we just, it goes back to understanding what your values and your mission and what your mission is, because that should be what informs your decisions, big and small. And so when we're thinking about our covers, we want to, it's very, very conscious internally that we make sure that our covers, our print covers across the board, are feature a diversity across gender and across people of color and everything. So we want to make sure that, you know, not every cover that we put out is a straight white man. We want to make sure that we have women there, that we have women of color, that we have, you know, men who are people of color too, that people that can talk to different experiences along their pursuit of success. And so, yeah, I don't know if I answered your question, but that is basically, a very conscious thing. And we're very conscious of, you know, when we're receiving editorial pitches and when we're reviewing what we, our content calendars that we are representing, you know, all the communities that we can, especially BIPOC communities. And, you know, we can definitely do more. What we just recently did actually was on our website, we carved out a specific section at the top of our website that says BIPOC, just to allow our users ease of access and navigation towards that specific content. Mm-hmm. And so we just want to not only make that content more accessible and more easier to find, but also just increase our coverage around it too. So there's always more work that we can do.
One thing you brought up that was very interesting is like, was the, you brought up it several times actually, was the art of the pitch and pitching you correctly, right? Mm-hmm. So let's run through this real quick, you know, because we're about to start pitching brands. We're about to start pitching publications. Because we're about to drop our, we actually recently dropped something called BWBU, Black Woman Bossed Up, a podcast playlist highlighting Black women in business, you know, showcasing everything you're just mentioning, being a woman, what their story is like, how they are exuding excellence in their business, right? And now we've realized that this is super important that we highlight Black men in business, right? How can I go about pitching that? Actually, should we do like a mock pitch? I think that could be even more fun.
Yeah, sure.
You guys think? Yeah.
Oh,
you
guys.
What would you pitch media? And you know, I think it's important to understand that not all media is the same. People obviously have different audiences and communities and, you know, perspectives. So it's not a, you know, one solution fits all kind of thing. You do have to curate and tailor those pitches. But what would you pitch us?
Okay. Freestyle off the top of my head. All right. Let's do it. Pressure on. So, dear Lance, how are you today? I want to bring this to your attention. We are releasing a podcast playlist called Rapper Go to the League. a podcast play that's highlighting Black men in business exuding excellence in their individual life. We think you should be promoting this and having a story on this because it showcases Black men in Canada and the US that are showing excellence in their business. We've had some excellent men, one including Pierre Laguerre, who raised the highest amount of money you can publicly raise using Republic. We've had O'Shane Howard, who is featured on both Vogue and GQ twice. We've had SP Badu, who's been on The Bay and Essence, and a lot of other men who are showcasing excellence in their business and exuding a positive image in our society. So it's a heartwarming story. It's a story showcasing entrepreneurship in 2021. And I would say deviates from the current narratives that are being portrayed on Black men. So I think you should write about this story. What do you think?
Also, yeah, add something sure. there too.
Go ahead.
Oh yeah, I'd finish it up with knowing what Bay Street Bull does, covering entrepreneurship and celebrating entrepreneurship. Your audience is primed for such a content like this. Recently, you featured covering Black-owned businesses, having a podcast playlist featuring Black women and Black men. I think this will bolster your content even more towards what you're doing with your current mission on featuring BIPOC businesses. And I believe this is a great collaboration, which represents great synergy. And I would love to talk more about it if this interests you. So I'll add that at the kicker right there, because
So one thing that I think you could continue and build on is that you're creating a playlist and you've curated a playlist of podcasts. And so you're implying that you are experts, subject matter experts. And so what I would want to learn more about is what makes you a subject matter expert, what you have as an authority on that topic that would lend credibility to the editorial pitch that you're pitching. And so give me reasons why, you know, you are the leaders that can speak to this kind of content, whether that's your involvement with the community, whether that's your coverage of the community, your understanding of it, things like that. So just give me a little bit more context on who you guys are as a brand and why you're the voice, why people should listen to you. And then just, you know, how that aligns with your overall values and mission as well.
Yeah. You didn't include that. That's so obvious. This is right there.
It's right there.
Yeah.
Honestly, it is like it is very simple, but it's not always easy. So, especially when you do this a lot, it's easy to kind of go back to basics. And so, even when you're doing pitches, like maybe carve out a checklist and be like, okay, my spoken a little bit about ourselves and why we're the experts on whatever we're pitching, why we lend credibility to that, what we can offer in terms of our, you know, how our voices offer value, and how they align with the person that you're pitching, and their audience, and what they're looking for and how it's timely or how it's, you know, evergreen content.
What do you define as expert?
Yeah, so I don't think that expertise always has to be a formal title or a formal degree that speaks to your expertise. It could also just be experience. If you have a podcast that speaks to your content matter and you've been doing it and you for a while and you're able to build a community, then that showcases the fact that you've built a community, you understand your community, and you understand the subject that you're talking about. And I mean, that helps as well, for sure. So just being able to communicate that you know what you're talking about and that you have a little bit of credibility and something to back it up.
Got you. No, that's solid. Awesome, man. I think that's a great note to wrap on personally, man. Is there anything we didn't cover that you'd like to cover? Actually, Mission Critical. That's been one of your latest projects that you've worked heavy on. I think it'd be a disservice to you if you didn't touch on it. You know, what was it like having Michelle Romano on the show? And what has been some of your top moments?
Reed, I think from a podcast standpoint, it was something new for me, a little bit outside of my comfort zone. The way that I interview people for print and online is very different in the way that I would interview someone for a podcast, because you have to be much more aware of your ums, buts, you knows, all that kind of stuff, even though it's edited out, and make sure that you're able to have a nice flow to the conversation that you would otherwise be able to edit out in paper and online. But honestly, it has been such a great way to speak with people. It offers a lot more of an intimate conversation with people, and allows the audience to really get a sense of who we are as a brand and our voice, but also who we're speaking to. And we intentionally want to make sure that we're not focusing just on people in business, but people across the field that can speak to pursuit of success, but also what informs their decisions in terms of their mission and their value. The common denominator is what has your experience been like building up what you've built, and what are your values that inform the decisions that you make? And it's been really, really, really great and interesting to see how they differ, but also how they're similar.
I've seen, I heard a lot of great stuff on the Michelle Robineau podcast. And I actually really enjoyed your Swish episode as well. That wasn't really a Mission Critical. That was more on your YouTube though, on the BSB TV YouTube channel. So I definitely suggest that, to check that out. We're working towards wrapping up. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to mention real quick?
No, I think we covered a good amount there. So, I mean, I'm just happy to be speaking with you guys today, and thank you so much.
Awesome. With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, the hustle is what you can control. So control your grind and control your life. I'm Alex.
And I'm Owen.
And I'm Lance.
Hey. And that's the hustle over everything, y'all. Peace.
Peace out, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening. The conversation continues on our Instagram at 24/7hustler. We post very frequently. And be sure to check out our merch at hustleovereverything.co. We have some amazing sweaters, hats, mugs, and a lot more. Lastly, our Proud to Pay program is linked in the description below. Thank you so much for your support. Talk to you next Monday. Peace.